John. The hill, jutted above the dense tangle of forest, rising solitary and sudden, its windswept heights visible for miles off. The wildlings called it the Fist of the First Men, Ranger said. It did look like a fist, Jon Snow thought, punching up through the earth and wood, its bare brown slopes knuckled with stone. He rode to the top, with Lord Mormont and the officers, leaving Ghost below under the trees. The direwolf had run off three times as they climbed, twice returning reluctantly to John's whistle. The third time, the Lord Commander lost patience and snapped, "Let him go, boy! I want to reach the crest before dusk. Find the wolf later!" The way up was steep and stony, the summit crowned by a chest-high wall of tumbled rocks. They had to circle some distance west before they found a gap large enough to admit the horses. "This is good ground," Thorin, the old bear, proclaimed when at last they attained the top. "We could scarce hope for better. We'll make our camp here to await half-hand." The Lord Commander swung down off his saddle, dislodging the raven from his shoulder. Complaining loudly, the bird took to the air. The views atop the hill were bracing, yet it was the ring wall that drew John's eye, the weathered grey stones with their white patches of lichen, their beards of green moss. It was said that the Fist had been a ring fort of the First Men in the Dawn Age. "An old place and strong," Thorin Smallwood said. "Old!" Mormont's raven screamed as it flapped in noisy circles about their heads. "Old! Old! Old!"
"Quiet!" Mormont growled at the bird. The old bear was too proud to admit to weakness, but John was not deceived.
The strain of keeping up with younger men was taking its toll.
"These heights will be easy to defend if need be," Thorin pointed out as he walked his horse along the ring of stones, his sable-trimmed cloak stirring in the wind.
"Yes, this place will do."
The old bear lifted a hand to the wind, and Raven landed on his forearm, claws scrabbling against the black ringmail.
"What about water, my lord?" John wondered.
"We crossed a brook at the foot of the hill."
"Long climb for a drink," John pointed out, "and outside the ring of stones."
Thorin said, "Are you too lazy to climb a hill, boy?"
When Lord Mormont said, "We're not like to find another place as strong. We'll carry water and make certain we're well supplied," John knew better than to argue.
So the command was given, and the brothers of the Night's Watch raised their camp behind the stone ring the First Men had made. Black tents sprouted like mushrooms after a rain, and blankets and bedrolls covered the bare ground. Stewards tethered the garrons in long lines and saw them fed and watered. Foresters took their axes to the trees in the waning afternoon light to harvest enough wood to see them through the night. A score of builders set to clearing brush, digging latrines, and untying their bundles of fire-hardened stakes.
"I will have every opening in the ring wall ditched and staked before dark," the old bear had commanded.
Once he'd put up the Lord Commander's tent and seen to their horses, Jon Snow descended the hill in search of Ghost. The direwolf came at once, all in silence. One moment, Jon was striding beneath the trees, whistling and shouting, alone in the green, pine cones and fallen leaves under his feet. The next, the great white direwolf was walking beside him, pale as morning mist. But when they reached the ring fort, Ghost balked again. He padded forward wearily to sniff at the gap in the stones, and then retreated, as if he did not like what he smelled. John tried to grab him by the scruff of his neck and haul him bodily inside the ring. No easy task. The wolf weighed as much as he did, and was stronger by far.
"Ghost, what's wrong with you?"
It was not like him to be so unsettled. In the end, John had to give it up. "As you will," he told the wolf, "go hunt." The red eyes watched him as he made his way back through the mossy stones. They ought to be safe here. The hill offered commanding views, and the slopes were precipitous to the north and west, and only slightly more gentle to the east. Yet as the dawn deepened and darkness seeped into the hollows between the trees, John's sense of foreboding grew. "This is the haunted forest," he told himself. "Maybe there are ghosts here, the spirits of the first men. This was their place once." "Stop acting the boy," he told himself. Clambering atop the piled rocks, John gazed off toward the setting sun. He could see the light shimmering like hammered gold off the surface of the milk water as it curved away to the south. Upriver, the land was more rugged, the dense forest giving way to a series of bare, stony hills that rose high and wild to the north and west. On the horizon stood the mountains, like a great shadow, range on range of them, receding into the blue-gray distance, their jagged peaks sheathed eternally in snow. Even from afar, they looked vast and cold and inhospitable. Closer at hand, it was the trees that ruled. To south and east, the wood went on as far as John could see, a vast tangle of root and limb painted in a thousand shades of green, with here and there a patch of red where a weirwood shouldered through the pines and sentinels, or a blush of yellow where some broadleaves had begun to turn. When the wind blew, he could hear the creak and groan of branches older than he was. A thousand leaves fluttered, and for a moment the forest seemed a deep green sea, storm-tossed and heaving, eternal and unknowable. Ghost was not like to be alone down there, he thought. Anything could be moving under that sea, creeping toward the ring fort through the dark of the wood, concealed beneath those trees. Anything. How would they ever know? He stood there for a long time, until the sun vanished behind the saw-toothed mountains and darkness began to creep through the forest.
John, Samuel Tarley called up. I thought it looked like you. Are you well?
Well enough, John hopped down. How did you fare today?
Well, I fared well, truly.
John was not about to share his disquiet with his friend, not when Samuel Tarley was at last beginning to find his courage. The old bear means to wait here for Corin Halfhand and the men from the Shadow Tower.
It seems a strong place, said Sam, a ring fort of the first men. Do you think there were battles fought here?
No doubt. You'd best get a bird ready. Mormont will want to send back word.
I wish I could send them all. They hate being caged.
You would too, if you could fly.
If I could fly, I'd be back at Castle Black eating a port pie, said Sam.
John clapped him on the shoulder with his burned hand. They walked back through the camp together. Cook fires were being lit all around them. Overhead, the stars were coming out. The long red tail of Mormont's torch burned as bright as the moon. John heard the ravens before he saw them. Some were calling his name. The birds were not shy when it came to making noise. They feel it too. I'd best see to the old bear, he said. He gets noisy when he isn't fed as well. He found Mormont talking with Thorin Smallwood and half a dozen other officers.
There you are, the old man said gruffly. Bring us some hot wine, if you would. The night is chilly.
Yes, my lord. John built a cook fire, claimed a small cask of Mormont's favourite robust red from stores, and poured it into a kettle. He hung the kettle above the flames while he gathered the rest of his ingredients. The old bear was particular about his hot spiced wine, so much cinnamon and so much nutmeg and so much honey, not a drop more. Raisins and nuts and dried berries, but no lemon. That was the rankest sort of southern heresy, which was queer, since he always took lemon in his morning beer. The drink must be hot, to warm a man properly, the Lord Commander insisted, but the wine must never be allowed to come to a boil. John kept a careful eye on the kettle. As he worked, he could hear the voices from inside the tent. Jarman Buckle said,
"The easiest road, up into the Frostfangs, is to follow the milk water back to its source. Yet if we go that path, Raider will know of our approach, certain as sunrise."
"The giant stair might serve," said Sir Malador Locke,
"or the Skirling Pass,
If it's clear.
The wine was steaming. John lifted the kettle off the fire, filled 8 cups, and carried them into the tent. The old bear was peering at the crude map Sam had drawn him that night back at Craster's Keep. He took a cup from John's tray, tried a swallow of the wine, and gave a brusque nod of approval. His raven hopped down his arm.
"Corn,"
it said.
"Corn! Corn!"
Sir Otin Withers waved the wine away.
"I would not go into the mountains at all," he said in a thin, tired voice. "The frost fangs have a cruel bite, even in summer, and now, if we should be caught by a storm—"
"I do not mean to risk the frost fangs unless I must," said Mormont. "Wildlings can no more live on snow and stone than we can. They will emerge from the heights soon, and for a host of any size, the only route is along the Milkwater. If so, we are strongly placed here. They cannot hope to slip by us."
"They may not wish to. They are thousands, and we will be 300 when the Halfhand reaches us." Sir Mador accepted a cup from John.
"If it comes to battle, we could not hope for better ground than here," declared Mormont. "We'll strengthen the defences. Pits and spikes, caltops scattered on the slopes, every breach mended. Jarman, I'll want your sharpest eyes as watchers, a ring of them, all around us, and along the river, to warn of any approach. Hide them up in trees. And we'd best start bringing up water, too, more than we need. We'll dig cisterns. It will keep the men occupied, and may prove needful later."
"My rangers," started Thorin Smallwood.
"Your rangers will limit their ranging to this side of the river until the Halfhand reaches us. After that, we'll see. I will not lose more of my men."
"Mant Raider might be massing his host a day's ride from here, and we'd never know,"
Smallwood complained.
"We know where the wildlings are massing."
Mormont came back.
"We had it from Cresta. I mislike the man, but I do not think he'd lie to us on this."
"As you say," Smallwood took a sullen leave. The others finished their wine and followed more courteously.
"Shall I bring your supper, my lord?" John asked.
"Corn!"
the raven cried. Mormont did not answer at once. When he did, he said only,
"Did your wolf find game today?"
"He's not back yet."
"We could do with fresh meat."
Mormont dug into a sack and offered his raven a handful of corn.
"You think I'm wrong to keep the rangers close?"
"It's not for me to say, my lord."
"It is, if you're asked.
If the rangers must stay in sight of the fist, I don't see how they can hope to find my uncle," John admitted.
"They can't."
The raven pecked at the kernels in the old bear's palm.
200 men or 10,000. The country is too vast."
The corn gone, Mormont turned his hand over. "You would not give up the search?"
"Maester Aemon thinks you clever."
Mormont moved the raven to his shoulder. The bird tilted its head to one side, little eyes aglitter. The answer was there. "Is it? It seemed to me that it might be easier for one man to find 200 than 200 to find one." The raven gave a cackling scream, but the old bear smiled through the grey of his beard.
"This many men and horses leave a trail even Aemon could follow. On this hill our fires ought to be visible, as fox fangs. If Ben Stark is alive and free, he will come to us, I have no doubt."
"Yes," said John, "but what if—"
"He's dead?
Mormont asked, not unkindly. John nodded, reluctantly.
"Dead,"
the raven said.
Dead. "He may come to us anyway," the old bear said, "as Arthur did, and Jaffa Flowers. I dread that as much as you, John, but we must admit the possibility." "Dead,"
the raven cawed, ruffling its wings. Its voice grew louder and more shrill.
"Dead."
Mormont stroked the bird's black feathers and stifled a sudden yawn with the back of his hand.
"I will forsake supper, I believe. Rest will serve me better. Wake me at first light."
"Sleep well, my lord."
John gathered up the empty cups and stepped outside. He heard distant laughter, the plaintive sound of pipes. A great blaze was crackling in the centre of the camp, and he could smell stew cooking. The old bear might not be hungry, but John was. He drifted over toward the fire. Dywin was holding forth, spoon in hand.
"I know this wood as well as any man alive, and I tell you, I wouldn't care to ride through it alone tonight. Can't you smell it?"
Gren was staring at him with wide eyes, but Dolorous Ed said,
"All I smell is the shit of 200 horses, eh? And this stew, which has a similar aroma, now I come to sniff it."
"I've got your similar aroma right here." Hake patted his dirk. Grumbling, he filled John's bowl from the kettle. The stew was thick with barley, carrot and onion, with here and there a ragged shred of salt beef, softened in the cooking.
"What is it you smell, Dywin?" asked Gren.
The forester sucked on his spoon for a moment. He had taken out his teeth. His face was leathery and wrinkled, his hands gnarled as old roots.
"Seems to me like it smells, well, cold."
"Your head's as wooden as your teeth," Hake told him. "There's no smell to cold."
"There is," thought John, remembering the night in the Lord Commander's chambers. "It smells like death." Suddenly, he was not hungry anymore. He gave his stew to Gren, who looked in need of an extra supper to warm him against the night. The wind was blowing briskly when he left. By morning, frost would cover the ground, and the tent ropes would be stiff and frozen. A few fingers of spice wine slushed in the bottom of the kettle. John fed fresh wood to the fire and put the kettle over the flames to reheat. He flexed his fingers as he waited, squeezing and spreading until the hand tingled. The first watch had taken up their stations around the perimeter of the camp. Torches flickered all along the ring wall. The night was moonless, but 1,000 stars shone overhead. A sound rose out of the darkness, faint and distant, but unmistakable, the howling of wolves. Their voices rose and fell, a chilly song and lonely. It made the hairs rise along the back of his neck. Across the fire, a pair of red eyes regarded him from the shadows. The light of the flames made them glow.
"Ghost," John breathed, surprised.
"So you came inside after all, eh?" The white wolf often hunted all night. He had not expected to see him again till daybreak.
"Was the hunting so bad?" he asked.
"Here, to me, ghost."
The direwolf circled the fire, sniffing John, sniffing the wind, never still. It did not seem as if he were after meat right now.
"When the dead came walking, ghost knew. He woke me, warned me."
Alarmed, he got to his feet. "Is something out there? Ghost, do you have a scent?"
Dywin said he smelled cold.
The direwolf loped off, stopped, looked back.
"He wants me to follow."
Pulling up the hood of his cloak, John walked away from the tents, away from the warmth of his fire, past the lines of shaggy little garrons. One of the horses whickered nervously when Ghost padded by. John soothed him with a word and paused to stroke his muzzle. He could hear the wind whistling through cracks in the rocks as they neared the ring wall. A voice called out a challenge. John stepped into the torchlight. "I need to fetch water for the Lord Commander."
"Go on then,"
the guard said.
"Be quick about it."
Huddled beneath his black cloak, with his hood drawn up against the wind, the man never even looked to see if he had a bucket. John slipped sideways between two sharpened stakes while Ghost slid beneath them. A torch had been thrust down into a crevice, its flames flying pale orange banners when the gusts came. He snatched it up as he squeezed through the gap between the stones. Ghost went racing down the hill. John followed more slowly, the torch thrust out before him as he made his descent. The camp sounds faded behind him. The night was black, the slope steep, stony, and uneven. A moment's inattention would be a sure way to break an ankle, or his neck.
"What am I doing?" he asked himself,
as he picked his way down. The trees stood beneath him, warriors armoured in bark and leaf, deployed in their silent ranks, awaiting the command to storm the hill. Black they seemed. It was only when his torchlight brushed against them that John glimpsed a flash of green. Faintly, he heard the sound of water flowing over rocks. Ghost vanished in the underbrush. John struggled after him, listening to the call of the brook, to the leaves sighing in the wind. Branches clutched at his cloak, while overhead thick limbs twined together and shut out the stars. He found Ghost lapping from the stream. "Ghost," he called, "to me, now." When the direwolf raised his head, his eyes glowed red and baleful, and water streamed down from his jaws like slava. There was something fierce and terrible about him in that instant. And then he was off, bounding past John, racing through the trees. "Ghost, no, stay!" he shouted, but the wolf paid no heed. The lean white shape was swallowed by the dark, and John had only two choices, to climb the hill again, alone, or to follow. He followed, angry, holding the torch out low so he could see the rocks that threatened to trip him with every step, the thick roots that seemed to grab at his feet, the holes where a man could twist an ankle. Every few feet he called again for Ghost, but the night wind was swirling amongst the trees, and it drank the words. "This is madness," he thought, as he plunged deeper into the trees. He was about to turn back when he glimpsed a flash of white off ahead and to the right, back toward the hill. He jogged after it, cursing under his breath. A quarter way round the fist, he chased the wolf before he lost him again. Finally, he stopped to catch his breath amidst the scrub, thorns, and tumbled rocks at the base of the hill. Beyond the torchlight, the dark pressed close. A soft, scrabbling noise made him turn. John moved towards the sound, stepping carefully among boulders and thorn bushes. Behind a fallen tree, he came on Ghost again. The direwolf was digging furiously, kicking up dirt. "What have you found?" John lowered the torch, revealing a rounded mound of soft earth. "A grave," he thought. "But whose?" He knelt, jammed the torch into the ground beside him. The soil was loose, sandy. John pulled it out by the fistful. There were no stones, no roots. Whatever was here had been put here recently. 2 feet down, his fingers touched cloth. He had been expecting a corpse, fearing a corpse. But this was something else. He pushed against the fabric and he felt small, hard shapes beneath, unyielding. There was no smell, no sign of grave worms. Ghost backed off and sat on his haunches, watching. John brushed the loose soil away to reveal a rounded bundle, perhaps 2 feet across. He jammed his fingers down around the edges and worked it loose. When he pulled it free, whatever was inside shifted and clinked. "Treasure," he thought. But the shapes were wrong to be coins, and the sound was wrong for metal. A length of frayed rope bound the bundle together. John unsheathed his dagger and cut it, groped for the edges of the cloth and pulled. The bundle turned, and its contents spilled out onto the ground, glittering dark and bright. He saw a dozen knives, leaf-shaped spearheads, numerous arrowheads. John picked up a dagger blade, feather-light and shiny black, hiltless. Torchlight ran along its edge, a thin orange line that spoke of razor sharpness. Dragonglass, what the maesters call obsidian. Had Ghost uncovered some ancient cache of the children of the forest, buried here for thousands of years? The Fist of the First Men was an old place, only... Beneath the dragonglass was an old war horn, made from an oryx horn and banded in bronze. John shook the dirt from inside it, and a stream of arrowheads fell out. He let them fall
and pulled up a corner of the cloth the weapons had been wrapped in, rubbing it between his fingers. Good wool. Thick. A double weave. Damp but not rotted. It could not have been long in the ground. And it was dark. He seized a handful and pulled it close to the torch. Not dark. Black. Even before John stood and shook it out, he knew what he had. The black cloak of a sworn brother of the Night's Watch.